You're listening to the Strategic Marketing Podcast with Omar Merlo and Andreas Eisengreich.
Just impro, I guess.
Could do. Yeah, let's go for it.
Just come up with one of your clever, funny questions. I always like those ones. not the breakfast cereal, though. All right, we're good. All right, everyone. Welcome to our second podcast. I'm Omar Merlo, Assistant Professor in Marketing and Co-Director of our Strategic Marketing MSc Online and Academic Director of our Face-to-Face MSc Strategic Marketing Program, and I'm joined by Professor Eisengreich.
It's a great pleasure to join again, and of course, Omar is always a great partner in crime. For my sins, I'm also head of analytics operations and marketing. And in today's session, we're going to talk about the airlines industry, amongst other things.
Yeah, because it's one of those industries that has been affected dramatically by the pandemic. You know, we have industries that are laughing all the way to the bank, like the online retailers, you know, the likes of Amazon and Ocado and so forth. They're doing really well. But, there are industries that are suffering. And, of course, people aren't traveling. The hospitality industry is suffering. And the airline industry is also suffering dramatically. And the airline industry, I've always been interested in it because it's such a challenging industry. It's one of those industries where it's very difficult to have a healthy profit margin. It's highly commoditized. Consumers can't really tell the difference between one airline and the next, and often shop based on price. And so it's already an industry that is very challenging. And this has only made things worse. What do you think are going to be the winners and the losers, Andreas, in these industries? Any thoughts? I mean, what will the airline that will win out of this look like?
Wow, that's the 1 million question. I think it's anyone's guess, but it's true. I mean, the airlines industry are definitely not like online gambling or sugar crush. They've got their work cut out. But I'm kind of excited about the industry because I don't know about you, Mark, but I'm just starving to get back on an airplane and just meet up with people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we forget how central to everything, to connecting the world, the airline industry is. And we're very fortunate today to be joined by two guests who are going to tell us a little bit about the challenges, the historical, I guess, challenges of the airline industry, what they're going through now, but also hopefully thinking positively about, is anything good going to come out of this? Is this going to lead to some innovation, some new things in the airline industry that perhaps are going to be for the better?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to this one. And it's great to have these guests for today's call.
So let me introduce our guests today. First, of course, Rob Britton.
Thanks for inviting me onto the podcast. I am a former executive of American Airlines in the United States and now an adjunct professor of marketing at Georgetown University, as well as a regular visitor to Imperial Business School. Delighted to be with you.
And we have Tony Anderson.
Hi, I'm Tony. I'm former marketing director of EasyJet and Easy Group, and delighted to be with you today.
I would like to get started, I guess, by talking a little bit about the airline industry. This is an industry that is suffering, but it's been a difficult industry historically. Rob, can you tell us perhaps a little bit quickly about some of the challenges, traditional challenges that the airline industry faces?
Well, thanks, Omar. There's a lot of them, but I would just I'd focus on just two that are top of mind. One of them is the battle, if you will, between older carriers, so-called legacy airlines like BA or American Airlines or Delta, in competition with newer companies with lower cost structures, Ryanair and of course EasyJet, Wizz Air in Europe, JetBlue and others in the United States, and so that whole separation, the whole idea that there's two tiers of competitors, old companies and new ones, is really an artifact of history going back to the times when the industry was either state-owned or very deeply regulated by the state. Regulations, not operational, but economic regulation, like price setting and control of entry and things like that. So that old-new dichotomy is really something that all airlines, older ones, continue to work through. The second thing that I would lift up that affects every carrier, whether it's a young one or an old one, a green one or a blue one, is the fact that the industry has very high fixed costs. fixed expense, roughly speaking, 70 to 80% of total. And that, of course, is what is giving airline executives a heartburn and nightmares right now, because demand is down. So a company like BA or Lufthansa, they can park the airplanes because there's very little demand, but they still have to pay for them. They have to pay for the assets. They have to pay rent at airports. They have to pay for staff that cannot be quickly or easily furloughed, et cetera, et cetera. So that fixed expense reality is really coming to roost right now, 8 or 9 months into the pandemic.
Thank you. That's really fascinating. Now, of course, everyone keeps talking about the challenges and so forth, but is there any upside to this? Are there any opportunities that you're excited about, Tony?
Yeah, first of all, just coming back to Rob's point, it's interesting for EasyJet to be classified as a new carrier, given it's just celebrated its 25th anniversary. So I guess at some point that will run out. In terms of opportunity, I like to think of the airline industry as being a barometer of the economy, but it's a special kind of barometer. It's a barometer on steroids. So when the economy goes down, then the airlines start hemorrhaging money. Similarly, when the economy picks up again, there's opportunities for bounce back. And, you know, this is an industry where you tend to lose vast sums of money very, very quickly. And as such, it's almost Darwinian in nature. One of the things, as we know, that Darwin wrote about was the tendency for species to become extinct, the survival of the fittest. We've already seen a number of carriers drop by the wayside in the period leading up to the pandemic. And I think the carriers that do survive this will emerge stronger and more competitive than they were previously. So there will be opportunities. I think this is a little bit different from other recent crises where, you know, even take an event like the Twin Towers attacks. Yes, there was a short-term impact on travel, but within a year, the industry had come roaring back. This might take a little bit longer. One way of looking at it, you know, the airline industry has fallen down a lift shaft and now it has to take the stairs back up. It's going to take a while.
You know, 25 years ago when EasyJet launched, a lot of people didn't think it would last a week. And, you know, the airline lasted for well over two decades. The interesting thing, though, is that after 25 years of annual profits, the airline just posted its first annual loss in 25 years. And I believe it's about, what, $1.3 billion or something like that. And what explains that in your view? And to what extent is that directly linked to the pandemic?
Well, we're in good company. So, yeah, EasyJet was modeled very much as have been other European low-cost carriers on the success of Southwest Airlines. So Southwest was born out of the deregulation of North American aviation in the 1980s. And it's totemic amongst low-cost airlines. It's turned in a profit year after year in this industry that's awash with red ink. Everyone thinks they must be doing something right. Well, guess what? In the midst of this pandemic, Southwest has recently announced that it's contemplating layoffs. Southwest has never, ever in its history contemplated layoffs. So that's a sign that this is special. This isn't your regular downturn that's, you know, that comes with ups and downs of a cyclical industry. This is, I like to think, a once in a generation event. And it's very difficult for people to prepare for. I think every airline is going to lose money. And it's a question of how well you weather the storm and position yourself for the recovery that counts. But I think losing money in this environment is no surprise.
Thank you for sharing, Tony. I mean, this is really, really interesting. And Rob, we read a lot about U.S. airlines. What is your reading of the U.S. airlines as an industry right now? And then if you want to take a sort of a look into the crystal ball for next year, what's your prediction in terms of the U.S. airlines doing next year?
Well, I think that I would echo what Tony said. I mean, every carrier everywhere in the world is in the same world of hurt. And it's really hard to sort of go region by region and say some are doing better. I guess probably the only place is Australia, you know, where they have, from a public policy standpoint, managed the pandemic very well. And air travel seems to be returning slowly to normal. But I think the consensus view in the United States is that 2021, you know, we will see demand beginning to return. And essentially, and this is not distinct to the United States, but essentially airlines here in America, as elsewhere, are really in a race. And there are sort of, you know, the contestants in the race. The one contestant is liquidity and cash position of airlines. And the other contestants are the return of demand. And if demand returns before airlines run out of cash, then they will survive. But that may not, as Tony has suggested, happen. But the view is that I think the I would sort of characterize it as optimistic, realistic view, is that by the end of the second quarter, so halfway through the year, the consensus view is that everyone in the United States will be vaccinated. And therefore, you know, there should be no reason for travel not to bounce back. Leisure side bounce back very quickly, both for pure holiday making. So the holiday in Hawaii is going to come back, and the kids taking the kids to Disney World is going to come back. So-called personal travel, what we call VFR, visiting friends and relatives, will bounce back very quickly. People will want to go see their high school chums in LA and Aunt Edith in Des Moines. The real question is how much of business travel will bounce back, how quickly. Now, there's been a lot of so-called experts and savants who have said, well, Zoom is going to replace business travel. I don't think that's going to be the case. But again, the consensus view seems to be that it's going to take a couple of years for business travel demand, as we define it, and that's a big bucket of different kinds of people. But business travel, broadly speaking, a couple of years from now, it will be in the United States at 70% of total. And that 30% fall off will be Zoom substitution or simply just budget cuts that won't allow somebody to travel in person, et cetera, et cetera.
I think it also, I guess, crises are a great opportunity for innovation and reinvention, right? It forces people to start actually thinking about novel ways to connect with customers, create value, reach out. I mean, American Airlines, of course, is launching this home test that it's giving passengers, but also EasyJet has introduced this new cabin trolley home delivery service. We've seen some airlines, I believe some Asian airlines, introducing these flights that go nowhere, that you get on board, you have a restaurant meal on board an aircraft, and then you get off and you go home. So there's been these interesting innovations. Now, Tony, have you witnessed any innovations, any good things coming out of this, things that again, symptom that the airline industry is looking for novel ways to connect with customers, is finding ways to find new revenue streams, etc.?
I think you have to differentiate between what I would describe as the more tactical, opportunistic initiatives of the sort you've just described, and perhaps the more strategic, meaningful, long-lasting type of products innovation that may stick with us for longer. So in the latter category, I'd put something in, like, for example, the efforts that airlines have been making, particularly in China for domestic travel, with allowing all-you-can-eat travel passes. I think this has been introduced and trialed in a couple of other countries as well. But those types of product change, I think, may stick around. And some of this novelty stuff, you know, really, it's not going to make a fundamental difference when you've got airlines that have got, you know, trying to replace revenues that run into EasyJet's case, £5-6 billion a year. You know, whether you can pick up £500,000, £1 million from, you know, some of these more fringe activities a year, of course, it helps. But in terms of meaningful, substantive change, I don't think it does. So where are the big initiatives the things that will fundamentally stick with us?
Thank you, Tony. This is a really intriguing conversation. And one interesting question is, I mean, many of our listeners want to have a career in marketing or marketing related. What role of marketing do you see for airlines industries? Is there, you know, a role for branding and marketing, or what kind of role is it reduced to just pricing? Where do you see marketing in terms of the airlines industry? Maybe Tony first, and then Rob, both of you.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, marketing's always had a crucial role to play in airline operations, and it's changed a lot since EasyJet was born. I mean, a lot of people forget now, EasyJet was born as a direct sell airline. It's the first airline anywhere in the world to cut out the middleman in the travel agent. It was a telephone operation initially, and then was completely revolutionized, of course, by the dawn of the internet. And I recall Celia standing up at the launch of EasyJet, and the journalists who were present at that launch all laughed at the idea an airline could charge £29 for a flight to Scotland. They all said, you're going to be bust within 6 months. Well, if someone had said at that moment, yeah, but give it another few years, you'll have an airline selling seats for £1, Ryanair, and they'll be one of the most profitable airlines in the planet, everyone would have laughed. And I think that owes, you know, that so that's really points to two things. I think the first is the huge growth in ancillary revenues and the changes that's meant to the airlines' business models and where they derive their revenue. But the second is this stimulating demand for people to travel more. And that's got to be marketing driven. You know, EasyJet's set out to get people to fly for the first time. Well, its success was built on getting people who already flew to fly more. And I think that's the big marketing challenge ahead, is getting those people who used to fly 4 or 5 times a year to get back to that pattern of frequent travel. You know, persuading them to do so is going to require a lot of marketing skill and you know, very targeted marketing activities. So there's not going to be, in my view, a shortage of opportunities for skilled marketeers in the years ahead.
Rob, what are your thoughts?
I think I would, Tony's spot on in that. I mean, I think if I were to if I were to put on for a moment my sort of marketing professor hat, I would say, you know, if we looked at the four P's of the marketing mix, if you will, you could just tick down through those and see there to be opportunity for young aspiring marketers across each of those four P's. Tony referred to the growth of ancillary revenues, these other things that airlines can sell people as an element of sort of creativity and pricing. If we look at place or distribution, I mean, we're going to continue to make progress in terms of the way that the product is sold and through direct selling. I mean, one of the innovations, for example, that is contemplated but sort of whispered about a bit is the creation of a secondary market among those, among those carriers that where when you buy a ticket, it's yours and it's 100% non-refundable, like Ryanair or some carriers in the United States. That notion that the ticket is not transferable, which has historically been an artifact based in security and other sorts of things. I mean, I think that there are people nibbling at the edges of allowing there to be a StubHub. I don't know if they trade in the UK, but these secondary markets that are used when you cannot attend a rock concert or a football match, sell your ticket online and the intermediary takes a swipe and you get a little chunk of the residual. Those things are likely to come about in the next 10 years. So those kinds of innovations and on the promotion side, clearly the biggest driver of promotional activity, if we think narrowly about that P of the marketing mix, has been loyalty programs and frequent flyer programs. And those programs continue to get, you know, more creative, more innovative, more flexible, which is a really good thing. And so again, all across those things, there are going to be opportunities for, you know, for clever marketers to come in as long as they understand to put put the brakes on a little bit, as long as they understand the fundamental financial realities of the business. This is not a packaged goods business. This is not a high margin business, you know, where you have unlimited amounts of marketing resource to throw at something. This is something where the marketing budget, broadly defined, will always be constrained.
Now, Rob, you mentioned loyalty programs, and the airline you worked with for a long time invented loyalty programs back in the 80s. And it's interesting because the airline industry is one of those rare contexts in which loyalty programs have actually generated loyalty. Well, in many others, You could probably think of them just as data collection exercises rather than driving any repeat purchase. Why is it, do you think, that a loyalty program has played such an important role in the airline industry and it's worked effectively in your industry and not so much in others, like retail, for example?
Well, prior to American Airlines launching the first loyalty program in 1981, branded as Advantage, the company understood that, and they were really right. I mean, they said this program is going to do three things. First of all, it's going to create a stickiness with our customers, a closer relationship with our customers, and therefore drive increasing share of wallet. And that turned out to be absolutely true, and partly because of early on the novelty, but subsequently because, you know, it does generate something of value to the customer and certainly to the airline. The second thing that they understood was that it would, if you chose to use it, these programs would generate terabytes and terabytes of useful information about what people buy, when they buy, how much they buy, et cetera, et cetera. Information that could be used really for a variety of reasons, a variety of purposes. And so in a sense, arguably, airlines early on were really inventors of sort of big data because we understood that that information would be very, very useful. And the third thing that they came to understand, they weren't sure about this at the beginning, but subsequently came to understand, was that if your program was big enough, you would be able to sell points or miles to third parties. And so every large airline has built a great business selling points to banks, for example, with co-branded credit cards, selling points to hotel companies, other related travel companies. And so all those things taken together have created a really very powerful sub-brands for big companies like American or Delta or BA.
Thank you so much, Rob. And Tony, what is your thinking on these loyalty programs or other ways of building loyalty? Is it even possible to build real loyalty in an industry, airlines industry context?
Well, I'm going to answer your question in maybe an unexpected way, Andreas, because I think now is a good time to start talking about the elephant in the room that none of us have mentioned so far. You know, it's standing there. It hasn't gone away through the pandemic, and I'm talking about climate change. So we are in a world where there is already pressure on airlines to cut emissions and for passengers to take responsibility for the impact of their activities on the climate. Companies are recognizing this, a significant proportion of individuals are recognizing it, particularly younger ones. There is talk of regulators stepping in, whether that's at national or regional level, for example, at the EU. And I don't think those pressures are going to go away. And I think there is going to be at some point a conflict between the desire for people to go out and travel to the extent to which they've done previously and a regulatory or kind of moral pressures on them to say, limit your travel in some way, whether that's actually legally mandated or is just kind of peer pressure or whatever. But it is the elephant in the room. We've tended to forget about it for the last 9 months, perhaps understandably, but it's still there. And until we can get electric aeroplanes, which seems to me to still be some way away, I think we're going to feel some of that tension.
I remember back in, I believe it was 2006, when the Bishop of London famously declared the flying is sinful. It's like murder and stealing. Rob, what do you make of that?
Right. Yeah, I think that Tony is exactly right. It is the elephant in the room, and we're acknowledging and pointing, and there he is, and the elephant is really big and gaining momentum in many parts of the world, particularly in Europe. And so I think that, you know, without being defensive, the airline industry really needs to tell people a few things. First of all, you know, no need to deny the fact that engine emissions from aircraft are 2 to 3% of the gases responsible for climate change. But it's not 20%. And I think, first of all, start with that as sort of base facts. And then the way that I look at it is, I think we should really take this head on, and I think we should say, yes, okay, 2 to 3%. What does the world get for those 2 to 3%? We get holidays, we get market expansion, we get the opportunity to hug loved ones, we get educational exchange, all of these kinds of things. And so, like anything else, there's a balance. There's a cost. Of course, there's a cost involved. But there are these enormous benefits that accrue to people that I think we always need to remind folks of. And at the same time, that we're sort of talking the sort of, we're giving people the sort of facts and data, the 2 to 3%, you know, where sometimes eyes glaze over. We really need to apply, you know, these wonderful principles of promotion. You know, the best advertising is the stuff that appeals to people's emotions. And so while we're talking facts and data, we also have to talk in emotional terms, because that's clearly the way that our critics are talking. I mean, when Greta Thunberg gets the microphone, you know, she's not talking facts and data, she's talking about emotion. And so we need to counter that. And I think that the airline industry, broadly speaking, has started to master the first, facts and data. You know, they're putting out all these press releases with all these numbers and blah, 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 blah. But the emotional argument, it needs to be put forward as well. And the opportunity to, as I said, go have a holiday somewhere else and renew yourself, to hug your aunt and uncle and your high school comrades, those kinds of things that the airplane distinctly and uniquely makes possible, needs to be brought to the fore.
Yeah, I'm not sure I entirely agree with Rob's view. I think there is a generation emerging which looks at things slightly differently. And while I agree that it's easy to take the airline's contribution to global emissions out of proportion, I think there is also some specific questioning, for example, about the acceptability of airline travel for very short trips. So in particular, those where the trip might be potentially made by. So where I stand on those individual judgments is kind of a decision that I make every time I fly. But I can tell you that my kids, who range in age from 15 to 26, have very different views from me. You know, that's a fact. That will influence their buying decisions. So I think we need to, it's more nuanced than black and white and yes or no. You know, one end of the spectrum, you've got Michael O'Leary from Ryanair probably, and at the other end, you've got out and out eco warriors. And I think the airline industry has to be a bit more intelligent about this and engage and take on its responsibilities and show that it is part of the solution as well as part of the problem.
I think you're just talking about emotions. I still remember my first flight I visited were yesterday. So maybe just a bit of a curveball here for Rob and Tony. Do you still remember your very first flight in your life? And what is it that you remember when you took your first flight?
I do. It was June 1966. And my buddy Greg and I rode our bicycles to the airport. And we bought a return ticket for $10.50 and flew 72 miles. That's the kind of short flight that Tony was just talking about. Flew 72 miles from point A to point B. And the thrill of taking off was what I remember.
What aircraft was it, Rob? Remember?
It was a Boeing 727-100 on Northwest Airlines. And it was thrilling. And it was like, after that, it was like, this is a pretty cool business. I should, you know, I didn't really know at the time that I would end up spending my working life in, but I certainly understood that it was a special kind of opportunity and the view from above. You know, you don't get very high when you only fly 72 miles, but you got at least high enough so that you could see the world and look down below and see it in all its complexity and richness. And that was remarkable.
What about you, Tony?
Well, technically, I guess my first flight would have come about the age, I must have been about 9 or 10. We'd constructed this go-kart, me and my friends, out of, we'd read some book on how to do things, and one of my best mates had a had a father who was very handy, and we put together this go-kart and we took it down to a quarry near our house, down a very steep incline. Now, we must have been airborne for about, I must have been airborne for about 2 seconds. And that flight ended in accident and emergency at the local hospital. So I remember that very fondly. It didn't put me off the airline industry, though. And
I hope you got some frequent flyer points from that.
Yeah, exactly. I live to tell the tale. That was my first flying experience. In truth, I can't remember when my, yeah, it would have been some family holiday off to the Med somewhere, and I probably would have slept through it, which is what I tend to do on most flights.
I think mine was an Alitalia flight to Sicily with a really old beaten up DC-10. It was already old for some reason. And it was rather terrifying, I remember. It was exciting and terrifying at the same time. What about you, Andreas?
It was actually an El Al flight to Israel, out of all places. And I just still remember how big the knives were on those flights. Like back in the day, they would give you proper cutlery and everything. And people were still clapping when you landed. I don't know, it's crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's funny how a lot of that stuff, you know, the cooked meal, the fancy cutlery, it's all disappearing. It's amazing that someone came up with the idea that, you know, an airplane was a good place to cook a meal and present it hot to consumers. It's just such a crazy idea. And how long it took for the industry to realize that maybe, you know, it's something that customers can do without, right?
So maybe because Christmas is coming soon, if you had one wish for Santa, what kind of wish for the airlines industry would you make?
Santa would vaccinate everyone in the world with one of the vaccines, and so by New Year's Day, 2021, we'd all be able to fly without fear.
I think for me, it's, you know, my heart goes out to the people who have been displaced by this pandemic within the broader aviation sector. You know, tens of thousands of people, good people, have lost their jobs, you know, careers brought to a halt. A lot of pilots who've invested heavily in their futures have, have had real trauma. And, you know, at this Christmas, I guess I'll be thinking of those guys and hoping for a swift return to normality.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Well, I would like to thank everyone for participating today. Rob, thank you so much. Tony, thank you. Of course, Andreas. And our listeners do not realize that we have people behind the scenes also that make this happen. We have Andrew and Harriet, who are amazing in making these podcasts happen. I would like to thank them as well for all your help, guys. Thank you so much. Until the next one.